The title of the sermon series that I want to start today is Unforgettable. The 12 disciples of Jesus spent 3 extraordinary years with him, traveling around Galilee and Judea, listening to Jesus teaching, seeing the amazing things that he did. It obviously left a very deep impression. And in an age before diaries and books and stuff like that were common, people trained their memories to retain information far more than they ever do today. If I lose my diary, I've lost my memory. It wasn't true back in the day. And so remembering the words and the works of Jesus was not really so difficult for them, especially because those were living shared memories, memories that were constantly being talked about and shared among the disciples. And after Pentecost, indeed, were part of the teaching of the early church. And above and beyond that, you find in the Gospels every now and again words of Jesus that obviously were absolutely unforgettable. So the whole thing was easily rememberable, but one or two things were absolutely unforgettable. How do we know that they were? Well, we know that they were absolutely unforgettable because when Jesus spoke, he spoke in a language called Aramaic. And the New Testament is written in a different language. It's written in Greek. And 99.9% of the time, therefore, the gospel writers simply translated what Jesus said and did into Greek. But there are a few words and phrases that made such an impression on them that 30 years later, Jesus' disciples could still hear the very sound of them inside their heads. These were literally unforgettable. We're going to look at some of those Aramaic words in this series. The first one comes at the end of a long narrative in Mark chapter 5, and I want to begin reading at verse 21. Mark chapter 5, verse 21, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the sea. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter's dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she'll be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. And a large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all that she had. And yet instead of getting better, she was getting worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus also realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" His disciples answered, "You can see the people crowding against you, and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter's dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He didn't let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed him to scorn. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and he went into where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was about 12 years old. At this they were completely astonished. Jesus gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. Everything about that day was extraordinary. It begins with a respected member of the community acting in a deeply undignified way. Actually, I'm going to put this up a little bit. It's a little bit low for me, and you can probably still see my face, which is not necessarily good. Okay, there we are. One of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet, is what it actually said. And there are two things that are odd about that. The first is that this man is a pillar of the community. He's somebody who is somebody he's looked up to. He's an important man, and yet he falls at the feet of Jesus, a mere itinerant preacher. He throws all of his dignity out of the window. He's forgotten his position. He's not worried about what people are going to say. This man is driven by the desperation of love, and he does something that in any other situation would be deeply anachronistic and rather humiliating. Now, not every father would have had this intensity of concern for a daughter. Girls were not rated as highly as sons and heirs and all that sort of stuff. But this little girl is the apple of her father's eye, and she's desperately sick. And the father comes and he falls very publicly at the feet of Jesus. He begs and pleads with him to help. "My little daughter's dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she'll be healed and live." That's the first thing that's odd about this. The second thing is that he has a name, this man. Now, generally in the Gospels, the 12 disciples are mentioned by name. And then there's a whole army of extras, if you like, that come in and out of the story unnamed. They bring their questions, their needs, their illnesses, or their opposition. 10 lepers, a woman with a hemorrhage, a demon-possessed man, and so on. You know what they are, but you don't know who they are. And of course, they all had names. It's just that the gospel writer doesn't know what their names were. But this man, he does. He's called Jairus. He isn't somebody who steps into the story of Jesus and then steps out again. He's remembered. And almost certainly that is because he also has become part of the Christian community. Jairus is part of the Christian church in, well, wherever he lived at the time. He also is unforgettable. Something has happened here on this day that has caused a deep and lasting faith to grow in this man's heart. And what we read here is his road to faith, and it's a pretty remarkable one. It begins with desperation. There is a crisis that propels him to seek out Jesus. His daughter's dying. He's at his wit's end. He would not normally search out a visiting preacher, a miracle worker, but these are not normal times. And so he comes very publicly, without dignity, he falls at Jesus' feet, he begs, he pleads, and Jesus goes with him. The desperation of extreme need can sometimes be the trigger that gets us looking to the Lord for something that we cannot manage by ourselves. There's no shame in that. So far, so good. But then the second thing is delay. He's going along the road, Jairus all the time willing Jesus to go faster, all the time the crowds holding him back as they mill around, when suddenly for no apparent reason Jesus stops dead. He absolutely stops in this really, really urgent situation. Jesus turns around, "Who touched my clothes?" And it seems a crazy situation because, of course, there are people coming and going. There's people pressing in from every side. And there are hundreds of people who must have touched Jesus, all milling about. But Jesus has felt something. He's felt power going out of him to touch the life of someone else. And he wants to know who it is. A woman comes forward. She's suffered from a hemorrhage of blood for the past 12 years. It's debilitating. It's embarrassing. It is shaming. It has wrecked her life. She is ritually unclean. She's all sorts of stuff. She is not an acceptable person in society because of this horrible thing that she's got. But she believes that Jesus might have the answer. So she comes. She doesn't dare to voice her request openly, face to face with Jesus. She doesn't even dare to look him in the face. She comes up behind him. She touches his clothes. She thinks, well, I'll not commit myself here. I'll not make a fool of myself, but I will see if there is anything in this. So she sneaks up behind. She touches Jesus' coat, and astonishingly, something happens. And then, totally embarrassingly, Jesus has turned round and demands to know who she is. Verse 33 says, "Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth." Prepare for a Morel moment. I'm going to be sexist here. My experience is that when a woman tells you the whole truth about her situation, it is not a two-minute job. There are all sorts of details that tend to come out that I wouldn't ever dream of including. Some of them tend to come out more than once. And so this Jairus, willing, begging, pleading for Jesus to move on, get a move on. He's thinking of his little girl's life ebbing away. He's tapping his watch, or he would be if he had one. He's drumming his fingers. He's stamping his feet. Everything about his body language is saying, impatience, impatience, impatience. Come on, come on. But Jesus stands and listens to this woman telling her life story. Now, I cannot imagine just how frustrating that must have been, or what that poor man went through. One of the hardest things, I think, when we're trying to trust God is waiting. And this man has had to wait and wait and wait for this troubled woman to finish talking. Finally, she reaches the end of her story. And in verse 34, Jesus says to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." Now, why has Jesus done all of this? I think it is partly because there are important things going on here that Jairus simply cannot see. It is important for that woman not just to receive physical healing, but also to know that she is clean, that she's acceptable, that she has peace. This has to be a public thing. And if that involves some embarrassment along the way, then embarrassment is a price worth paying for the healing that Christ brings. There is at least one occasion when I've stood at the front of the church here on a Sunday morning, an absolute gibbering wreck, to receive prayer. I could have chosen on that occasion not to expose my emotions as I did. I could have bottled them up and taking them back home with me. It would have been possible to do that, but I knew that it wasn't the road to emotional healing. There are times when embarrassment is the price for letting God do something in our lives that is really important. At the end of all this, the woman with a hemorrhage is healed physically, emotionally, perhaps also socially, because Jesus has publicly declared her clean. Now that's great for her. It isn't just so great for Jairus, because just at that moment, a posse arrives from his house. And they say, "Well, she's dead. Why bother the teacher anymore?" What they don't quite say, but what they really mean, I think, is, "He didn't seem all that bothered about your dead daughter anyway." The Lord really doesn't care. And then that leads, thirdly, on to disillusion and disappointment. That woman's got her miracle, but I haven't got mine. And you know, it can be absolutely galling, can't it, when you're going through one of those times when nothing's working for you. And I think a lot of us have been through those times in our Christian lives. And then you find yourself in the company of folks who are full of the wonderful things that God's doing in their situation. They're over the top, happy, clappy, while your world is coming apart at the seams. And the more triumphalist that they are, the harder it is to cope with. And it is hard not just to feel disappointment, but also disillusion at that point. There is something inside your head that says, "I might as well give up. God obviously isn't interested in me. He's doing it for all those other people, but he's not doing it for me." It's dead easy to give in to cynicism. You may have been there. I think I've been pretty close myself on occasions. Some of you may have had stuff that you've been praying for years and years, and you feel that God has forgotten you. Then disillusion turns to desolation. Jairus arrives home to find half the town wailing loudly outside. The reports are obviously true. There can be no doubt about it. Inside his house, his beloved child is stiff as a board. She is obviously dead. At this moment, Jairus' world has come to an end. The worst has happened. all the years of tenderness, of nurture, of hugs and laughter, all the sound of her voice, the way that she used to skip into the house, the questions, the little idiosyncrasies, everything about the daughter that she has loved, all that brought joy and delight to mom and dad, it's gone. It's finished. How does faith find a way beyond that kind of numbing loss? And then I think the final straw is derision. Because through all of this, Jairus is desperately clinging on to hope and faith by his fingertips. Jesus has said, don't be afraid, just believe. And something in Jairus is still trying to do just that. But his faith is met with laughter. Verse 39 says that Jesus went in and said to them, why all the commotion? The child is not dead but asleep. But they laughed at him. The old version says they laughed into scorn. Now it's true that it's Jesus that they're laughing at, not Jairus, but it is Jairus' hope and pain that they're trampling on when they do that. He must have felt like a knife being pressed into his heart, turned around. Few, if any of us, will have experienced all of those tests to our faith. Most of us, I think, will have experienced some. So what on earth do we do when our faith is pummeled like that? Jesus encourages Jairus to do three key things. First of all, he encourages him to hold on. You know, when we think faith, we tend to think about having positive thoughts, rejoicing, riding on the crest of a wave. When we've got faith, we're in a really, really positive place. When the New Testament talks about faith, often it links it with endurance, just holding on for dear life, persevering, keeping on going when you don't feel like keeping on going. In the 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 4, Paul, for instance, says, therefore, among God's churches, we boast about your perseverance and faith, your endurance and faith in all the persecutions and trials you're enduring. Faith and endurance, they go together. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 27 talks about Moses. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He endured, he persevered, because he saw him who was invisible. His faith was shown by his endurance. I remember we had in Sheffield a church just up the road from us, which embarked on a massively ambitious building project. It was the 1970s. And the building project started off at about £500,000, and it just went up and up and up and up. And the resources were patently nowhere to be found for that. But they believed that God had called them to do it. And as the thing went on, it kept on looking impossible. Actually, at times, it looked more impossible than it did at the start. And I remember the vicar saying, well, we've learned that faith is not riding on the crest of a wave. It is holding on by our fingertips. It's holding on by our fingertips and refusing to give up. Faith is sometimes that. Now, nobody can tell me that Jairus went through all of that climactic day thinking positive thoughts, singing happy worship songs. What he did do was he did not give up. He stayed with Jesus. He stayed the course. Whatever he felt, he wasn't about to let go. He was still there with Jesus at the end of his discussion with the woman with the hemorrhage. He's still there when the news comes of his daughter's death. He's still there with Jesus when they arrive at the synagogue, when the crowds are laughing scornfully, and when Jesus goes into the room where the little girl is laid out, he stays. And there may be times in your life when you're just holding on and it almost seems impossible. I think you should know that at those times, God doesn't berate or blame you because you cannot think positive, happy thoughts. Or because you cannot summon up spiritual passion or whatever people around you think that you ought to be producing. At those times, I do believe that the Lord first and foremost says to us, don't let go. I'm not going to let go of you. Don't let go of me. Hold on. Second thing that Jesus encourages him to do, which I think is relevant to us, is to believe for better. You know, I sense this is one of the things that Jesus really loves about and warms to in the woman who interrupted the journey, the woman with the hemorrhage. She's been sick for 12 years. Who knows how many prayers she's prayed in those 12 years? Who knows how much she's spent of her money and suffered from medical treatments? Mark says in verse 26 that she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all that she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Incidentally, it's interesting how doctors stick together, isn't it? Because Dr. Luke, when he writes his gospel, puts a slightly different gloss on that. He says in chapter 8 and verse 43, a woman who was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but nobody could heal her. That's a lot more generous than what Mark says. It's a lot more positive assessment of the medical profession. They stick together, don't they? But at any rate, who knows how much she's spent? Who knows how much she's suffered? Who knows how many prayers that she's prayed and not got answers? There was plenty in this woman's experience that could have led her to be fatalistic. She's tried nothing, everything. Nothing will ever change. She could have said to herself, I've been like this for so long. I will always be like this. Nothing is ever going to change this. To her immense credit, she doesn't give in to fatalism. She keeps believing for better. It's worth going to Jesus and seeing what he can do for me. And Jesus brings that same challenge to believe for better to Jairus. Jairus' girl is sick. The girl dies. The situation is seemingly hopeless. And Jesus says, don't be afraid, just believe. Don't be afraid, keep on trusting. It does seem to me that there's a real temptation for us to be fatalistic sometimes in our faith. I've been defeated by this temptation for 10 years. I might as well give up. You know, don't we do that? I've prayed for 10 people to be healed. None of them has been. It'll never happen. I might as well give up. I've witnessed to loads of people, but not been able to lead any of them to faith in Christ. Obviously, I'm no good at it. I might as well give up. And there can be a kind of fatalism that comes into our faith. And as I read the Bible, it seems to me that God honors people who refuse to take no for an answer when we're dealing with stuff that is clearly God's will. Keep saying to us in situations that might seem useless, don't stop believing for better. Don't accept the status quo. Third thing that Jesus does is that he switches off from the noise of unbelief. You know, it's interesting what happens when they arrive at the home of Jairus at the synagogue, especially in response to the laughter and the scorn of the crowds. You might have thought that Jesus would say, okay, you're laughing now, but you come in here and I'll show you. You might have thought that he'd want them to be there so that they could see the miracle and all that sort of stuff. But he doesn't. No, what he says, what we're told is that he put them all outside. And only when the noise of unbelief was switched off did he go with the parents of the little girl and with three trusted disciples, and he raised her back to life again. Now, the noise of unbelief is corrosive. Let me be clear what I'm saying here. I don't believe we should ever switch off from serious questions, whether it's our questions or the questions of our friends. We should never switch off from that. Genuine doubts you have got to face up to. You've got to look them in the face. You've got to work through them. But the culture of unbelief, the atmosphere of unbelief, is something different. I went to university to do theology, obviously, a year or two ago now. It was known as a liberal faculty, which means people didn't believe very much. What I thought when I went there was, I'm going to face all sorts of arguments against my faith, and I'm really going to have to think them through. And it'll be intellectually difficult. In truth, it didn't happen. They came up with nothing significant that I hadn't already spotted for myself. There was very little in the way of intellectual challenge. But when you live 3 years in an atmosphere of corrosive cynicism and unbelief, there is something about your own faith that begins to wither inside. And the truth is that it began to happen. It wasn't the arguments, it wasn't the substance, it was the culture and the atmosphere. The same, I think, will be true if we spend hours and hours soaking up the culture of the mass media. It isn't that you will meet all sorts of questions you cannot or shouldn't try to answer. It is just that the atmosphere of unbelief seeps through your skin and becomes part of you. And we need to beware of letting ourselves get immersed in a culture of cynicism and disbelief. So here we are, we're finally at the synagogue and the synagogue ruler's house. There are six people who go into the room where the young girl dies. There's Peter, James and John, there's mum and dad, and there's Jesus. After all the drama of the day, all the noise of the crowd, all the roller coaster of emotions, five of them are looking at Jesus. They're wondering, what is he going to do or say next? Are we going to have long prayers? Are we going to have a special sort of, some special ceremony? Are we going to have incantations? What are we going to do? What amazing thing is going to round off this day? None of those things. Instead, there are just two words that electrify them. Two words that are echoing in their heads 30 years later, Talitha kum. Why are those words remembered? Why are those words and not 1,001 other words that Jesus spoke remembered? I suspect there's something in the way that Jesus speaks them. It may be the tenderness and the love that comes out in them. Maybe the calmness when everybody else's emotions are utterly fried. There is something about the way that Jesus says those words that you can still hear 30 years later. Secondly, there is the matter-of-fact achievement of something that is utterly impossible. Jesus speaks those two words, Talitha kum. He takes the hand of the girl that everybody thinks is dead, and she gets up. Mummy, Daddy, what are all these people doing here? Everybody's absolutely astonished. Well, you would be, all but one. Jesus is incredibly matter-of-fact about it all. Says the two words, gets the girl to her feet. I think we'd better give her something to eat, don't you? This is a moment when every person present knows that there is nothing impossible for Jesus. There is no mountain that you face that he's not higher than. There is no problem that you meet that he's not the conqueror of. He is the Lord. That stays with you. And then I think, thirdly, this is a kind of advance notice of the amazing good news that Jesus has come to bring. Because resurrection is not just an extraordinary but incidental part of his ministry. It is what Jesus is all about. And the day will come when it's not a dead girl who is raised, but a crucified Savior. The day will come when it is Easter Sunday. And his resurrection will not be just one more random event affecting no one but himself, but the start of the second half of history. Jesus is the resurrection man, and what you've glimpsed for the first time in one little girl's bedroom is a tide of hope that embraces everyone who believes, everyone who chooses to be part of the Jesus revolution. It's the beginning of a tide of hope that embraces everyone in every age who belongs to him. When Jesus says, Talitha kum, he's acting out a promise that is for you and me and for eternity. I want to invite you this morning to faith. If you've never trusted Christ before, this would be a fantastic moment to do it. I want to encourage you to hold on to your trust if you're in a place of darkness. I want to encourage you to believe for better if you're in a place of fatalism. I want to encourage you to hear the voice of Jesus above the clamor of voices inside your head and from people all around you. And believe that voice. And it may well be that today it would be good to let others minister in prayer to renew our faith, help us break out of situations that hold us captive, to invite Jesus to do a new thing in our heart and life. I want to finish just by inviting you with me to identify with somebody in that story that we've read this morning and to hear, open your ears to hear what Jesus is saying to you. So let's just take a moment of reflection. It may be good to close our eyes. Maybe just ask yourself, who is it in what we've read and talked about that, who is it that I identify with? Do I identify with Jairus coming with a desperate need, struggling with faith? Do I identify with that woman who's lived with a problem for 12 years and nothing seems to be getting better and there's a real temptation to fatalism? Do I identify with the girl's mother in the background, not saying anything, but feeling all the same stuff? Do I identify with that little girl? Helpless, almost as it were dead, and not able to do anything for myself. Do I identify with the disciples walking with Jesus, wondering what he's going to do next and desperately wanting to learn to do it with him? Who do you identify with? And then, as you kind of place yourself in this story, what is it that Jesus is saying to you? What's he wanting to speak into your life? What is the word that he's wanting you to respond to? Jesus, thank you that you are the resurrection man. That you're the one who brings life out of death, hope out of hopelessness. Who touches prone, hopeless lives and says, Talitha kum. I say to you, get up. Lord Jesus, you are the one who plants and grows faith in our hearts. And our prayer is that you would grow our trust, our faith, the muscularity of it, the positiveness of it, the strength of it, the almost the cussedness of faith that refuses to stop trusting you even when we're under trial, that believes for better, that ends up seeing a miracle. God, plant and grow that faith in our hearts. Amen.